Raj Patel. Raj is has many hats on at the same time. Right now, he's a visiting scholar in the Center for African Studies at UC Berkeley. He's a fellow at Food First in Oakland, and he's a research associate at the School of Development Studies at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Raj has been a leading figure in developing analysis of what's called the world food system, a global food system, and I'm sure he will be talking a lot about that and also understanding the resistance there too. He's editor of Promised Land, Competing Visions of the Agrarian Reform, which Food First published in 2006. He's also author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, which came out in 2008, right here. And without further ado, Raj, thank you very much for coming.
Thanks very much for bringing me down. Harriet was saying that flying me down here, my carbon footprint is well on its way to being as big as Al Gore's. So, yes, I'm keen. I was very nervous, of course, to come before a body as august as this with my meager ideas, which would be subject to the withering critical scrutiny for which this body is well known. But I was made yet more nervous by the fact that, of course, the thing didn't print out, so I'm having to wing it at the moment. The only consolation, I think, is that history will repeat itself as fast later on this evening when Harriet and I subject the meal to which we are to be invited to the same critical scrutiny. Now, I want to talk, in essence, about the same thing as Harriet is. And I want to talk about this idea of food sovereignty. It's an idea that's been circulating a great deal over the past couple of years. You'll have seen it touted as the solution, in one way or another, to the global food crisis. And yet, on the part of people who use it, even, there's not really a firm sense of what food sovereignty is. I mean, it's almost sort of like art. We couldn't really define it, but we would know it if we saw it. And I wanted to actually sort of try and nail down a little bit what food sovereignty is and why it's important. Because it is it's an idea that has its genesis in one of the world's largest social movements, the La Via Campesina, which is an organization of peasant movements that, by its own estimation, has around 150 million members. In the United States, its prime mover is the National Family Farm Coalition. But around the world, you will find a range of movements that are, that range in size from sort of 20 million strong Karnataka State Farmers Association to the more modest National Farmers Union, for example, in Canada. To understand the case that I want to make about food sovereignty is that it is both a diagnosis and a prescription about the current world food crisis. And to be able to make that case, I want to head to definitions. I want to look specifically at the definition of food sovereignty. And I know it's the sort of last, the first refuge for the intellectually slovenly to go straight for definitions. But I think it's useful to look particularly at food sovereignty because the trouble, one of the interesting phenomena, features of food sovereignty, is that there are half a dozen definitions that don't look like they belong together. And I'm going to try and explain why that is and why the definitions of food sovereignty are sort of constantly changing. To do that, though, I want to start with what food sovereignty isn't. Food sovereignty is very much a rejection of, a completion of an older idea, food security. Food security, the first sort of notable definition of it comes from the 1970s, 1974. If I had the printout, I'd be able to read it to you. But basically, the definition of food sovereignty was couched in a kind of Malthusian language. Food security, was that situation where governments had sufficient supplies of food to be able to feed the hungry. And when a definition like food security is couched in, you know, in this sort of language of supply, that should definitely set Malthusian alarm bells ringing. I mean, and the definition of food security was a creature of its time. In the 1974, this was the time of the Sahelian famines. It was the time of the first oil shock. It was a time where the Club of Rome's ideas were circulating widely. Thanks so much. Here's the 1974 definition. Food security is, quote, the availability at all times of adequate world food supplies of basic foodstuffs to sustain a steady expansion of food consumption and to offset fluctuations in production and prices. So you've got a sort of Malthusian supply moment there. You've also got this idea of commodity price fluctuation. And remember, of course, in 1974, this is one of the sort of the high watermark for the calls for a new international economic order, where UNCTAD, the UN Conference on Trade and Development, was going to be an institution that would stabilize commodity prices globally. Food security in 1974, very much a sort of creature of its time. You can read off a number of geopolitical phenomena by examining the definition, which is why it's interesting then to see how this idea of food security morphs, how it changes over time. So I just want to give you a definition of food security that comes from 2003. And it's a much more, it's a definition that has much less to say about states and much more to say about individuals. The definition is that food security is when all people at all times have physical, social, and economic access to safe, sufficient, and nutritious food that meets their dietary needs for a full and active life. There's no talk there about commodity prices. There's no talk there necessarily about supply. It's about access. And in a sense, I mean, that's more progressive. I mean, in a sense, it's more proximate to the idea of a human right to food. Food security in 20 years or so later, after 1974, becomes something that is closely allied to the idea of human rights. Now, one can view that as progressive, but one can also view that as, It's written at a time of U.S. The triumph of U.S. Neoliberal capitalism. This definition was born of a time where human rights where a new international economic order was unthinkable, and where organizations like the United Nations, the Food and Agriculture Organization, even third world governments were looking increasingly irrelevant to the provision of food. And this definition of food security was, in many ways, an invitation for the market, for capitalism, to provide access to food. There was no talk about the government anymore because the market would do it all. The trouble with food security, as Via Campesina noted, is that you can be food secure in prison. You can be food secure under a dictatorship. It is possible for you to have access to sufficient quantities of food, according to this definition, and for you to be without liberty. That's what Via Campesina was actively rejecting. Via Campesina wants to bring in questions about power, wants to bring in questions about freedom. And to understand why, and to understand why it's important, I wanted to sort of take a detour. I want to tell a sort of short dialectical tale about the World Bank. And I want to put it in context so that we can understand its role in the current food crisis and why it is one of the organizations explicitly targeted in definitions of food security. So the World Bank, of course, initially had nothing to do with agriculture. It was at its inception a bank designed to help foster European reconstruction and development. The first sort of agricultural thing that it did was a diplomatic treaty. It helped broker a water-sharing treaty between Pakistan and India. But in general, it didn't, for the first 20 years or so of its existence, bother with implementing agricultural projects, and you know, there are various reasons for that. And the World Bank was trying to increase its credit rating, and in the international context, agricultural projects didn't provide a high or sufficiently risk-free return in the same way that investment in industry did. So that's what the World Bank, World Bank spent a long time investing in industry. And so by the end of the 1960s, there were still only 11 people at the World Bank who were tasked with doing anything to do with agriculture. That changed with the arrival in the early 1970s of the new bank president, McNamara, who arrived with the blood of the Vietnam War still wet on his hands. And he sought to bring about a transformation in the World Bank, and he singled out agriculture as the vehicle through which he would be making his mark through the World Bank. He said, quote, that agriculture, which has for so long been the stepchild of development, close quote, he was going to single that out for particular emphasis. And oddly, through the 1970s, the bank actually engaged in some fairly useful policies. They encouraged and funded the creation of grain reserves, grain marketing boards, agricultural extension mechanisms. They funded and supported increased state involvement in agriculture and providing minimum support prices, these sorts of things for farmers. Of course, that was all to change in the 1980s with the rise of Milton Friedman's style of economics. The winds of economic dogma changed, and the World Bank found itself, you know, sort of helmed by glassy-eyed monetarists who, through the 1980s, basically undid a lot of what it did in the 1970s. It started defunding the grain stores and the marketing boards, and a range of these sort of insurance mechanisms that were created to help stabilize prices throughout the 1970s. All of those were undone. Indeed, the effects were disastrous. Of course. The World Bank had a particular vision about bringing the invisible hand into agriculture through the 1970s, through the 1980s, and of course the invisible hand was nowhere to be seen. If we wanted proof, we would go to a recent. There's a report that came out last year that colloquially tore the World Bank a new one, and this was a report on the World Bank's massive failures in Africa, in African agriculture in the 1980s, and the report was written by the World Bank's own internal evaluations unit. But we didn't have to wait till last year for a report to come out to tell us how bad the World Bank was. Almost from the moment of the inception of its agricultural policies through the 1980s, there were choruses of protests. Well-founded observations that the bank's policies of shrinking the state, floating its exchange rate, and promoting markets were actually damaging the capacity of developing country farmers to be able to feed their own populations. So what did the bank do? I mean, it started in the 1980s with these structural adjustment policies. And it's interesting to see how the World Bank responded to the chorus of protest, particularly if you're following the wave of university occupations that are happening today, and you're thinking that this looks rather like the 1960s. The World Bank behaved as universities, you know, the World Bank in the 80s behaved as universities did in the 1970s. When students were sort of demanding, we want a seat at the board, we don't feel like we're being listened to. Well, the World Bank transformed itself into a listening bank. And just as university students were invited in to be given a seat at the university, and then they were able from that seat to see the university carry on pretty much as it did before, except with more cultural studies professors. The World Bank also had a protest of consultation. And it went out to sort of meet and discuss and talk with its stakeholders, and it created a sort of political economy of consultation where various kinds of NGOs interested in receiving frequent flyer miles and nice trips to Washington, would all of a sudden sort of be formed and purport to represent social movements in rural areas. And this process, rather terrifyingly, was called adjustment with a human face, where the bank sort of engaged in this sort of fraudulent kind of pseudo democracy, where it was sort of doing a sort of shadow puppetry of genuine engagement with its stakeholders. But of course, it never talked to movements of rural peasants who wanted, for example, radical land reform or profound agrarian transformation. Those people were never consulted with. And yet the consultation mechanism and the idea of reaching out to the poor is something that remains integral to the World Bank sort of mythos. I've got enough time to tell the time bandit. This is my one contribution to pedagogy, which is, if you're trying to explain the World Bank to someone, and feel like they need a hand getting into the idea of structural adjustment and conditionality, poverty reduction strategy papers, these sorts of things, then there's a visual metaphor that works very well, and it's from the Terry Gilliam film Time Bandits. I'm not sure if anyone has seen that film. Time Bandits is about disgruntled former employees of God. The universe was built in 6 days, so it was a rush job. And God had helped, but he doesn't treat his employees very well. So they run off with a map of the universe and all the holes in it, and they start robbing people. And in one scene, they rob Napoleon. And they jump through a hole, and they end up in Sherwood Forest, where they're met by Robin Hood, who's played by John Cleese, the sort of upper-class twit. He sort of introduces himself as Hood. And Hood's very excited to see all Napoleon stuff, and he said, this is tremendous. Thank you very much indeed. The poor will love this. Have you met the poor? They're charming people. Of course, they don't have two pennies to rub together. That's because they're poor. And there's this beautiful scene where Hood is giving out Napoleon stuff to the poor. The poor are brought on, and Hood sort of walks down the line and sort of handing out sort of gilded mirror for you. Oh, congratulations, jolly good. Ruby for you. How long have you been poor? Jolly good. And then right next to him is this big bloke who takes whatever Hood has given and punches the person in the face. So that's how the World Bank works. It's accurate. I was involved in a World Bank project called Voices of the Poor. Can anyone hear us? Which can be sort of paraphrased as, yeah, have you met the poor? They love us. Some of our best friends are poor. We had dinner with them the other day. And of course, there is a sort of myth and a sort of self-congratulatory moment of giving out the loan, but of course it's a loan, so it has to be paid back. And the punch in the face comes with the various conditionalities that are imposed on developing country economies, particularly in agriculture. That means imposing free markets for the good of the recipient. And of course, as we know, there is no such thing as a free market in agriculture. You don't have to take my word for it. We could use the words of Dwayne Andreas, who, when he said this, was the chairman of Archer Daniels Midland, one of the biggest grain trading companies. And Dwayne Andreas said this in 1995, but it remains particularly relevant today. Andreas says that there is not, well, I mean, he says the competitor is our friend and the customer is our enemy. And there is not one grain of anything in the world that is sold in a free market, not one. And the only place that you see free markets are in the speeches of politicians. And people who are not from the Midwest do not realize that this is a socialist country. Until recently, I found it very hard to persuade Americans that we were living in an economy where the government was in the business of giving billions of dollars of handouts to its favorite corporation. Recently, that's become a lot easier to be able to make the case for. But in agriculture, it has ever been thus. And I think that's you can see the consequences of that when you see how World Bank structural adjustment loans have impacted developing countries. I mean, let's look at Haiti, for example. Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, a country that at the beginning of the 1980s grew the majority of its own rice. But because of two IMF World Bank structural adjustment loans undertaken by Ronald Reagan and by Bill Clinton, the Haitian economy was forced to compete on the international market. Now, Haitian rice farmers had the capacity to be able to grow rice, they had technology, they had water, but they didn't have a chance when forced to compete against the U.S. rice industry. The Cato Institute estimates that the U.S. rice industry is subsidized to the tune of $1 billion a year. Haitian rice farmers were prohibited from subsidy because that would be the right and appropriate market discipline. And as a result, the Haiti today doesn't grow any of its own rice. You know, it is now entirely dependent on U.S. rice imports. And last year, when the price of rice went up, and we can talk about what happened last year if people are interested, and we can talk about that in questions. But when the price of rice went up, the people were forced in Cité du Soleil, for example, to eat mud cakes. Cakes made of margarine and clay and salt and water. Which dry up your mouth as they go down and burn and keep hunger away for a few hours. And when there was food, there were food riots in Haiti, riots that were politically very articulate, that were calling for the restitution of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. But they were also riots for bags of rice that had the stars and stripes on them and the words gift of the people of the United States. So this is, I mean, and we can sort of talk ad nauseam about the examples, the consequences of the World Bank's particular vision, and not just the World Bank. It's part of a broader trend. The World Bank is, in a sense, the knowledge bank for a broader series of transformations in agriculture that have been meted out on the Global South. But if these are the consequences, Via Campesina has a very articulate response, and it is a response that gets that is ultimately about political voice. And so I guess I now want to sort of deliver on a definition of food sovereignty. And so this is the first definition of food sovereignty, and this came out in 1996 again at a World Food Summit in Rome as a response to the idea of food security. This is Via Campesina's first attempt to push the idea that merely being given access to food is insufficient, that people need the power to control the food system. And so the definition runs like this. Food sovereignty is the people's, countries, or state unions' right to define their agricultural and food policy. I'll do that. Food sovereignty is the people's, countries, or state unions' right to define their agricultural and food policy. Excuse me. Now, it's important to understand where that's coming from. Bear in mind, Via Campesina is a federation of movements large and small, you know, from 20 million strong to a movement, you know, to organizations of farm workers that have maybe a few hundred members. And it was vital within Via Campesina that any statement of what the future of agriculture would look like should not involve domination. So no one group should be able to lord it over another. And that's why this idea of food sovereignty looks kind of empty, because no one's imposing on anyone else a particular vision about what should happen here or what should happen there. That said, of course, to join Via Campesina, movements need to agree to a minimal set of principles, you know, a commitment to democratic practice, for example. To be a member of Via Campesina, an organization needs to be a large member-based organization. There are no NGOs that are part of Via Campesina. It's all farmers' movements in one way or another, or farm workers, or landless laborers. And that means that there is nonetheless a sort of minimal political set of ideas around, you know, democratic practice, around a minimal set of ideas around what might be done globally to improve things, and a diagnosis about the current crisis as being in part caused by the World Bank. I think that's part of the idea behind food sovereignty. But again, as I say, the idea of what food sovereignty really is thin. Because what it is it's a right to have rights. So, I mean, it's not a set of concrete demands. It's a right to be able to generate those concrete demands around what should happen in the food system. And this idea of a right to have rights is Hannah Arendt's idea. She talks about it in The Origins of Totalitarianism. And I want to quote it because it's remarkably similar to the rationale. I mean, this is a quote from The Origins of Totalitarianism, but it's remarkably similar to the kinds of rationale that are being offered by movements involved in Via Campesina. So this is what Arendt has to say about people deprived of rights. She says people deprived of rights are deprived not of the right freedom, but of the right to action. Not of the right to think whatever they please, but of the right to opinion. We have become aware of the existence of a right to have rights. And that means to live in a framework where one is judged by one's actions and opinions. And a right to belong to some kind of organized community. Only when millions of people emerged who had lost and could not regain these rights because of the new global political situation. Now, although she was talking about European colonialism and its blowback in the metropole, Arendt could have been describing the contemporary context of food politics, talking about the millions who have been disenfranchised from their right to anything because of the new global political situation. Sounds remarkably like the situation that Araghi calls depeasantization, the creation of what Mike Davis calls the cities of slums. So this idea of a right to have rights has a certain kind of intellectual trajectory in Western thought, and the thinkers who tend to pick up on it tend to be sort of Habermasians. Saleh Ben Habib, for example, runs with this idea of a right to have rights and heads in sort of Kantian direction, talking about how the kinds of communities that we need to build as a result are communities that are informed by cosmopolitan federalism and moral universalism. The trouble is, for Ben Habib, the kinds of communities where there are intersecting layers where peoples and communities and countries can exercise their rights, well, for her, this kind of layered, international, cosmopolitan, sovereign, sort of multi-layer sovereign community is the European Union. I think Ben Habib would say the European Union is very far from the perfect sort of Habermasian community, but it's getting there because there are lots of different layers in which lots of different which the political decisions can and are made. But that, I mean, it's hard to think of the European Union as other than a sort of a cascading system for not for sovereignty, but for policing and for capital. And the idea that I think is much more interesting, and in fact, where food sovereignty leads us to move towards, is to think about fracturing space, not in the sort of European Union kind of way, but to think about being of what it is to have a right to have rights in a series of different contexts. So the Eystad report, for example, that Harrod was working on, calls for different kinds of sovereignty depending on the question. So questions around water sovereignty and politics of water are framed in across a geography and a territory that looks different again from questions around culture, that looks different again through to layers or spaces through which questions of sovereignty around carbon dioxide, for example, and climate change are discussed. There are lots of different layers at which one could be sovereign, and those don't correspond at all to the Westphalian system of states. But imply a different kind of geography, a geography that, as far as I understand it, looks actually fairly Balkan. An idea of, and I'm using the ideas here of the anarchist theorist Andrei Grubacic, by whom I am very persuaded in his revisiting of the idea of Balkanization as a series of geographically and culturally overlapping alternatives to the Westphalian system. And that's why I'm excited by this idea of food sovereignty, because it is, in essence, a sort of invitation to conflict. Conflict between levels at which food policy is decided. Conflict between the nation, between the country and the people, and a state union and a region. And this conflict, I think, is interesting and important because it explains first why the definition of food sovereignty looks all over the place. Because, you know, let me give you a second definition of food sovereignty that happened last year. And you can see from this definition that things seem to have gone off, you know, gone off track. This is a much more substantive definition. Here it is. Food sovereignty puts those who produce, distribute, and consume food at the heart of food systems and policies, rather than the demands of markets and corporations. Food sovereignty prioritizes local and national economies and markets, and empowers peasant and family farmer-driven agriculture. Food sovereignty implies new social relations free of oppression and inequality between men and women, peoples, racial groups, social classes, and generations. I won't suffer you to listen to that again. If you were to look at that, you would see half a dozen contradictions within that definition. For example, talking about those who produce, distribute, and consume food. To talk about those people is to talk about everyone, and to sort of homogenize those differences, including the sort of transnational corporations that are rejected in the second half of that sentence. There's, of course, a glossing over of the key distinction in agrarian capitalism between farm owner and farm worker, and harmonizing those interests across classes is much harder than the proponents of food sovereignty might like to imagine. And finally, of course, this idea of new social relations sits weirdly next to a call for family farming, when family farming is one of, the family farm has traditionally been one of the oldest engines for patriarchy. But what I like about that definition, I mean, it's clearly a definition that was done in committee, but it's also a definition that changes over time. And that definition is a couple of years old. The slogan and the definition that came out of the Via Campesina conference in Maputo last October was, I think, very interesting because it iterated the definition. It sort of took the definition one step further and tried to make sense of the contradictions in the definition and tried to sort of work them through a little bit. And the new slogan, I think, is very interesting. The slogan now is food sovereignty is about an end to all forms of violence against women. Food sovereignty is about an end to all forms of violence against women. Now, of course, I mean, that may sound space cadet-ish. I mean, it may sound pathetically removed from the ideas of the World Bank and of the challenges that face agriculture and climate change. But actually, it's on the money. I mean, this food crisis has been a gendered phenomenon. 60% of the people going hungry are women or girls. And of course, in developing countries, it is women who produce the majority of the food, though they own a fraction of the means of production. But this isn't a call merely for women's property rights. The Via Campesina is very conscious of what they call the Trojan horse of neoliberalism, the idea of women's right to property. They're not saying that women shouldn't own property. What they are saying is that all forms of violence against women is not merely that women are not being allowed to own property, but there are forms of violence that happen within the home, domestic violence primarily, but then forms of violence that prevent women from getting a fair price for their product in the market, that prevent women from attending school because they've been forced to pay for school by a World Bank policy, for example. Forms of violence that stretch from the household all the way up to the World Bank and the World Trade Organization, which are explicitly targeted in this latest definition. So I think that there's this is a really interesting kind of Hegelian process this idea of food sovereignty being worked out and iterated again and again and again. And since this October definition, food sovereignty has been pushed forward yet further. I'm gonna end soon, but I do want to tell you about a couple of things. Firstly, of course, that food sovereignty looks very similar to the kinds of policy call that ISTAT, the International Agricultural Assessment on Knowledge, Science, and Technology for Development, you should have gone to acronym school. So this ISTAT report has has ideas around governance and politics that look very similar to food sovereignty when you cash them out. But I mean, earlier last week, a country passed its first national law on food sovereignty, Ecuador. Ecuador passed its first national law on food sovereignty to promote many of the ideas that are in the ISTAT report. So, you know, they're talking about agroecology, they're talking about land reform, and they. Chances are you didn't hear about it because it was only reported by one English language news agency. It was reported by Xinhua, that it was the Chinese news agency. And well, we can talk about China and agriculture if people are interested, because there are a series of great stories there. But again, I mean, that agricultural law has its contradictions. Indigenous people have said that they're concerned with the idea of land and territory that appears in this law, because it looks to them like peasant agriculture, which treats land as fungible in a certain sense. You know, good land over here is the same as good land over there. From an indigenous perspective, you can't, you know, land can't be sort of compared in that way. Land is territory. You can't commodify and substitute one territory for another. A territory is a territory. So there are those contradictions that undoubtedly will feed back into the discussion about food sovereignty in Ecuador. And I imagine there will be another iteration of that law, and you know, there will be sort of contradiction after contradiction, and we'll try and work it out. But I guess, yeah, this is to sort of summarize and conclude. I mean, the idea of food sovereignty was born of the failures that produced the current food crisis. And food sovereignty is a political response. It's an organic intellectual response to the failures of a capitalist food system. And it's very far from a totalizing solution. It's one that calls for a proliferation of ideas. And you know, everyone's inner Maoist, I think, should be pleased. That food sovereignty calls both for a kind of 100 flowers approach, but also a kind of permanent conflict, for a permanent engagement between spaces, between levels, a kind of permanent politics that obviously the Cultural Revolution failed so horribly to foster. It looks like a mode of politics that Stuart Hall would call a politics without guarantees. And this is interesting, I think, because it's sort of a contradiction to dwell on, that if we're talking about rights, surely rights are precisely guarantees, guarantees about what should happen. What should be permanent and enduring. But the wisdom of the food sovereignty approach is that it understands that there's nothing guaranteed, and that there's everything to fight for on the way to the promised land of a genuine right to food. And so maybe I'll leave it there, and I look forward to your questions and critique, and of course to dinner afterwards.
Thanks very much, Rob.